Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Thursday the 16th of July. Today, a revolution in energy policy as the government announces a historic shift away from fossil fuels.
There's no way that Britain can get out of it, so every political party is aboard on this one.
As Britain's unemployment surges to its highest level for 14 years, David Blanchflower says the government should spend money, not make cuts. And our critic Zan Brooks defends what many see as the indefensible Lars von Trier's new film Antichrist.
I would defend it against charges of misogyny. I don't think it's a misogynist film.
But first, the news headlines with Bill Overton.
The government is coming under increasing pressure over the lack of helicopters in Afghanistan from MPs who say the shortage is linked to the deaths of British soldiers. A Defence Select Committee report out today argues the Ministry of Defence should increase the number and the training of crews. Gordon Brown said yesterday the recent troop deaths were not linked to a lack of helicopters. A recent British offensive in Afghanistan aimed at increasing security before elections next month has seen a rise in casualties. 15 servicemen were killed in 10 days at the beginning of July. The number of people diagnosed with swine flu rose sixfold during the course of last week in some parts of England, NHS figures reveal. The virus is spreading fast across much of the country, and the total of those affected rose by 42% in the 7 days up to last Sunday, according to data provided by family doctors. One of Russia's most famous human rights activists, Natalia Estemirova, has been found dead in the North Caucasus. She was bundled into a van and abducted as she left her home in Chechnya on Wednesday morning, a colleague says. The Russian President Dmitry Medvedev expressed outrage at the murder and has ordered a top-level investigation. She'd been investigating human rights abuses in Chechnya for the Independent Memorial Group. A prominent group of children's authors and illustrators have said they'll stop visiting schools in protest against a new vetting scheme, which comes into place in the autumn. Golden Compass author Philip Pullman's described the Home Office policy as corrosive and poisonous to every kind of healthy social interaction. The vetting and barring schemes being managed by the Independent Safeguarding Authority, which was set up following the murder of schoolgirls Jessica Chapman and Holly Wells by Ian Huntley. And Tony Blair has been outed as a leading contender to become the first president of the EU after new Europe Minister Lady Kinnock let slip government backing for him. His spokesman says as the job doesn't officially exist yet, he doesn't consider himself a candidate. In today's sport, Andrew Flintoff has confirmed he'll retire from Test cricket after the Ashes. He says he hopes to become the best one-day player in the world and compete in the 2015 World Cup. And John Terry is joining Chelsea's pre-season tour of the United States, despite rumours he could be heading for Manchester City. Chelsea's chief executive, Peter Kenyon, stresses the club are not considering selling their captain. Now, for a look at today's papers, the Daily Mail leads with what it says is an affront to British justice. The case of Gary McKinnon, who's fighting extradition to the United States. He faces charges of computer hacking and could get a 60-year sentence if he's convicted. The Mail is furious that Labour MPs who had previously supported a review of extradition proceedings failed to actually vote for one. The Times looks at the row over helicopter shortages in Afghanistan and claims a top army general was warned not to interfere in politics by senior Labour figures. The paper quotes unnamed Labour ministers who accuse Army head Sir Richard Dannett of playing politics after he gave an interview demanding more equipment for British troops. Both The Guardian and The Telegraph focus on Energy Secretary Ed Miliband's plans for a green revolution. The Guardian describes how the government is seizing control of key parts of the energy sector in order to avoid global warming and create a roadmap to reach carbon emissions targets. But The Telegraph warns of 300-foot turbines coming to a landscape near you as it reports on plans for more wind farms. The Sun and The Mirror are more concerned with Michael Jackson's death, with The Sun asking whether his doctor was in any way involved. And The Guardian asks on its front page, was the Jackson death murder, reporting on claims he might have been killed by an anaesthetic normally only used in hospitals. You can keep up to date with all the day's news and sport on guardian.co.uk.
A historic change in energy policy was announced yesterday by the Secretary of State, Ed Miliband.
As we generate power in a cleaner way, we also need to use energy in a smarter way in our homes. In total in the plan, we show how cleaner sources of heat and better use of energy can cut emissions from our homes by one quarter compared to today.
Miliband says that in 10 years' time, 40% of Britain's electricity will come from low-carbon sources, renewables, nuclear and clean coal. To make that happen will require what he described as comprehensive changes in the UK's economy and society. Unveiling the government's energy white paper yesterday, he announced plans to slash emissions from power, transport, agriculture and industry. John Vidal is The Guardian's environment editor. He says it's a revolution.
I think so, yeah. I mean, we're talking a historic shift. We're talking the whole industrial revolution started by Britain depended absolutely on fossil fuels, on coal and what we now know is high carbon things. And we're moving away from that, and we're going to be the first country to move away from it really fast, and we're going to move it very, very significantly.
Does it go far enough in meeting the government's targets on climate change?
Well, Britain's the first country in the world to set such an ambitious target. It's got 80% cut in carbon by 2050. Now, this is law. It has to do that. So this is how you get there. And what it's worked out is the faster you do it, the easier it is. So it's going to go for 34% cuts within 11 years, 12 years. Now, this has never been attempted on any scale like this, ever, by any country. So, well, we don't know if we can do it, frankly.
do you think we can? I mean, it's very ambitious. Is it possible?
Well, I think everybody will say it's touch and go, and nobody... I mean, I think the wise money is probably no, not quite, but they can get a long way towards it, and they're putting up real money, so it's going to happen. So first of all, it's going to be nuclear power, low-carbon energy. It's going to be wind power, mainly offshore, but a lot of onshore stuff. There's going to be 3.2, maybe more, billion pounds going into household energy efficiency. The best way to save carbon is to stop using it in the first place, so every home in Britain will be given money to basically improve its energy efficiency. It's going to make a big difference.
But people will see their energy bills rise.
There will be, what the government says, and I think it's just plucked out of the air. They're saying 17% on average. I mean, it could be 27%, 10%, 50%. I mean, frankly, they don't know at this stage. But they're saying, no, it's going to come with cost. Now, but there's two other things, though. One of which is, what would be the cost of letting climate change has run away, and that's just uncalculable, or the cost of doing nothing and importing oil or coal or wherever from far away, and that's going to have energy is inevitably going to rise anyway. So to be fair to government, yes, there is going to be price increases, but these would have been inevitable anyway.
And 400,000 new green jobs.
Again, figure plucked out of just about anywhere you like. But yeah, there's a lot of money in you're talking about the offshore energy industry. You're talking about something on the scale of offshore oil. So this is huge, huge developments. I mean, very large ports being built, and I mean, it's a very, very big operation, this. And then you're talking about building the wind thing, building marine energy. There's all kinds of different things. The jobs will come from all kinds of places, especially in the city, big carbon markets developing. So 400,000 jobs, maybe. I mean, we'll see.
Now, Labour might not be in power in just over a year's time. Are the Conservatives...
They're aboard. And the Conservatives got up yesterday and said, well, basically, these are all our own ideas. And so they applauded. And to be fair to them, yes, Conservatives have pushed them very hard on this. And there's no way they're going to go back. Britain has got commitments. It has to abide by these laws. Now, these are set up by the EU. You've got the post-Kyoto agreement coming up in a few months' time. These things are unavoidable. There's no way that Britain can get out of it. So every political party is aboard on this one.
The threat of climate change is so grave, John. Is this enough?
Well, it's not just a threat. It's happening now. And all the research shows that there is real evidence of it happening, kicking in much, much faster and much deeper than anybody expected. So an 80% cut within 40 years sounds a huge amount, but actually it's not very much. It's only like 2% a year. I mean, we're really not talking very much at all. And already scientists are saying there's no way we can hold temperatures to 2 degrees with this kind of cut. We've got to go for 100% cuts. We've got to go. I was in Geneva yesterday. They were talking there, Britain's ecological debt represents 160% cut. That's what's needed. So we're talking about something very, very profound in the way we treat the atmosphere.
John Vidal, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/environment.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.
Also on The Guardian's website, we consider the proliferation of grasshoppers. Guardian.co.uk/G2 to find out about that. Alexander Chancellor, in his weekly column, looks at Dignitas, the Swiss clinic that assists suicides. That's at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. And what's more boring, cricket or golf? Let me have a think about that one. Stephen Moss attempts to find out. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/sport. Unemployment shot up by a record 281,000 in the 3 months to May, taking the jobless total to 2.38 million. That's the highest level since 1995. Trade union leaders described yesterday's figures as horrendous. I asked David Blanchflower, a professor of economics at Dartmouth College, and until a couple of months ago, a member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, which sets interest rates, what he thinks.
They're really not very good. I'd expected them to be this bad, but they really continue to be bad, and we're going to have, unfortunately, to see figures like this every month for a year or so. These are pretty bad.
You argued in The Guardian against spending cuts and for expanding quantitative easing. Why is that?
My worry is that unemployment is going to rise a lot, especially amongst the young, and we should be doing everything we can to boost the economy and to boost jobs. Voters want jobs, and I think that's really crucial. It seems to me that should be the central focus of policy, and we're seeing jobs disappearing far too fast, and the class of 2009 are struggling to find work.
What do you say to economists such as Nassim Nicholas Taleb, author of The Black Swan, who say that reducing debt should be the policymakers' top priority?
Well, the time to reduce debt is when we're out of the recession. At the moment, we're deep in a recession, and my concern is that you potentially could turn it into a depression. Once we can move into growth, then we can pay debt back. And oftentimes when growth comes, debt's paid back faster than people think. But we certainly shouldn't condemn a generation to unemployment.
You said that you're struck between the similarities between the patterns of the recession in the United States and that in the UK. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I've spent a lot of time over the last 2 or 3 years looking at what's happened in the US and what's happened in the UK, and there have been significant similarities. The UK really has lagged about 6 months behind the US, and in the US there's been several false dawns, but essentially they're now six quarters into a recession and very little sign of coming out of it. Employment numbers are still declining fast with very little light at the end of the tunnel. And I think that's a pretty good comparator for us. Recovery is a long way away.
What are the areas that you think the government could be creating new jobs?
Well, one of the things we need to do especially is to try and help the young. So creating new jobs, I've argued, with wage subsidies to the young, by cutting national insurance for them, but especially by increasing the number of college places, university places, because that's a much better alternative than being unemployed. And when unemployment rises, people apply more to go to college. So it's a really good idea to get people out of the labour market into education. And I've said many times, it's much better to have people in education than on the street.
David Blanchflower. My name's John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, Nicolas Sarkozy pushes through his plans to get France's shops to open on a Sunday.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
But first, Iran's state media say 20 people were killed in the aftermath of the contested elections last month. Tens of thousands of supporters of the opposition candidate Mir Hossein Mousavi took to the streets, saying that the elections were rigged in favour of the hardline President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. But Robert Tate, who's having to report from Istanbul from The Guardian because of reporting restrictions in Iran, says the death toll could be much higher.
The International Committee for Human Rights in Iran have spoken to various sources, including doctors at hospitals in Tehran, and they've also been in touch with family members of those who died. The hospitals, to give one example, say that on occasion there would be numbers approaching 30 or in excess of 30 in the morgue at any one time, and almost all of those had gunshot wounds, which were almost certainly as a result of the clashes that took place in the streets. One other anecdote, really quite a disturbing and graphic one, is that one woman has spoken to the website of the Islamic Participation Party in Iran, which is a main reformist party, and she said that when she was looking for her missing son, she eventually, after being sent from pillar to post, went to what was essentially a cold storage depot in the southwest of Tehran, usually used for storing dairy products and fruit. She went there and was shown hundreds of photographs of people who may have been her loved one, and she couldn't find the person she was looking for. She said that on her way out, she was taken to a room where she saw hundreds of bodies piled on top of each other. And at that point, she passed out from the shock, and when she regained consciousness, she found herself in a car. That really is a scary and really quite chilling anecdote. It's not the only one of that nature. One other lady who did eventually find her son said she went to a revolutionary court after being sent from pillar to post for weeks. And once again, she was shown a picture album of 60 people who'd all been killed in the demonstrations. And out of that, she did find her son.
Robert Tate. In France, a new law has been approved by Parliament that would liberalise Sunday trading. President Nicolas Sarkozy has been trying to push through the legislation, which he believes is vital for France's economy. Angélique Chrysaphis is in Paris.
Well, basically, the French Parliament has been looking at this idea of loosening the rules on Sunday working in France. Nicolas Sarkozy wants to reform France to make it a more entrepreneurial place. And one of his symbolic moves that he really wants to get through is to make shops open on Sunday. It's hugely complicated because at the moment there's a bizarre tangle of laws, which means some shops are open and some aren't. But he wants them mostly to be allowed to be open, and he wants tourists to be able to spend more money in these shops and French people to earn more.
But this legislation has stopped short of full Sunday trading, hasn't it?
Well, there's been a huge row over this for about 6 months, with opposition politicians and the church accusing him of abolishing Sunday and threatening the soul of France. It's been watered down slightly, but what's really interesting is one of his main arguments has been Michelle Obama, because she wanted to go shopping one Sunday when she was in France with her daughters, and Nicolas Sarkozy said he had to ring the shops to make them open in Paris, and he said, you know, this makes no sense at all.
Did that actually happen?
Yes, it did happen, and off they went to do their shopping in this very posh children's shop on the left bank, and the French opposition politicians were left reeling with this argument that, you know, it was all in the name of Michelle Obama to open the shops.
How will this legislation actually affect the shopping habits of the French, though?
Well, basically, the law, as you say, has been watered down, and it's very specific. Under the new law, shops in France's three largest metropolitan areas, so we're talking about Paris, Marseille and Lille, but not Lyon, will be permitted to open on Sundays. So some employees would have the choice to refuse Sunday working, and they would be able to work to earn more money to work on Sunday. But then shops in another series of areas and towns and villages that are deemed to be of touristic interest can also open, but they won't get double overtime. So already it's starting to look hugely complicated. Basically, if you're in any big city apart from Lyon, it should make a big difference to you.
And is it possible to determine what effect this will have on the economy?
Well, that's the big argument. I mean, France has the biggest number of tourists in anywhere in the world visiting each year, but these tourists don't spend as much money in France as they do in other countries, for example, the US, or even in Spain and Italy. So one argument is tourists will spend more money. Another argument is shop workers will make more money. Now, unions aren't too happy about this because, as I've said, we're not sure how much overtime people will be paid. So there's a little bit of scepticism, especially on the left, about how much difference this will make.
Angélique, many thanks.
Feel the seat underneath you. Feel yourself sinking down into it. Enfolding you. It's a nice feeling. All you feel is a pleasant warmth.
A big fat art film fart was what Variety said about the new film from Danish director Lars von Trier, Antichrist. Time magazine said it presented the spectacle of a director going mad. The Guardian's film critic Zan Brooks quite liked it.
I guess this is basically Lars von Trier's nightmare. He wrote it on his sick bed, supposedly after sort of battling depression. It's a paranoiac story. It's about, it stars Charlotte Gainsbourg and Willem Dafoe as a grieving couple who retreat to their cabin in the woods, and there everything goes haywire. It's a film that has the gender wars playing out. It's a film that has quite explicit genital mutilation in it. And it's a film that also has a talking fox that appears to tell us that chaos reigns. And that seems to be the worldview of the film.
The feminist writer Julie Bindel, writing in today's Guardian, says this is the sickest general release in the history of cinema.
Well, that was the general feeling when the film premiered at the Cannes Film Festival the other month. It was called an abomination. It was called a film that hates women. And it was referred to as the spectacle of a director having a breakdown, that it was it posed the spectacle of a director going mad. So that was the general consensus of it. And Lars von Trier was actually sort of barracked at the press conference when he tried to defend the film.
Even though Charlotte Gainsbourg did win an award at Cannes.
She did win the award. And again, that caught a lot of people by surprise. And yeah, I think it is kind of justified. I'm not even sure if technically you could say it's a great performance, but it's certainly a brave performance.
Do you like the film?
I do like the film. I'm sort of aware that I'm going to be a real pariah for saying this. And, you know, sometimes maybe films, you don't always wear your favourite films as sort of badge of honour. Sometimes they can be a badge of shame. And maybe this does say something about me. And yet I would defend it against charges of misogyny. I don't think it's a misogynist film. If you define misogyny as someone who hates women or believes that men are superior to women, I don't think that film qualifies. Certainly it doesn't qualify on the latter count. Basically, for the purposes of the drama, Lars von Trier sets up the Willem Dafoe character as the embodiment of kind of patriarchal reason and order, and Charlotte Gainsbourg as the agent of chaos and nature. Maybe that's a bit of a cliched kind of gender stereotyping, and yet the film, if anything, portrays the Willem Dafoe character as much more flawed and weak and oppressive, and the Charlotte Gainsbourg character as vital and in some ways more sympathetic than Defoe.
Will this be Lars von Trier's final film?
Well, he's saying that he's taking a hiatus. The thing with Lars von Trier, and I think it's a thing that complicates people's responses to his films, is that you're never sure quite how much to believe him. And this film is in the same vein, in that it is loaded with kind of booby traps and little games and little jokes and things that are kind of deliberately designed to get a rise out of the audience. So now Lars von Trier is saying that he has had this depression, and he still has this depression, and he's now going to be kind of puttering around his garden, leading the life of a convalescent. But, you know, you have to remember that before Antichrist, he said he wasn't making another film at all anyway. So, you know, I think take everything that he says with a pinch of salt.
And what's the talking fox all about?
The talking fox, apparently, this is all from Lars von Trier's life. Again, do we believe him? Who knows? Lars von Trier said that he went on what he calls shamanistic journeys as a young man and actually did meet a fox in the woods and had a conversation with the fox, and the fox told him that chaos reigns. So here is the fox embodied in his new film.
Well, I'm glad that's sorted out. Zan, many thanks. Zan Brooks. Ian Chambers and Harriet Grant produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.